Welcome to Creative Disturbance. This is From Genius. I'm Yuna Lee, and I'm talking with Dr. Pamela Gossin at the University of Texas at Dallas. Pam, would you please introduce yourself?
Hi, Yuna. I'm a historian of science, and I'm also a professor of literature, and I also direct the Medical and Scientific Humanities program at UT Dallas. A lot of what I do is teaching the history of science to future STEM teachers, and also interdisciplinary arts and humanities, things that combine literature and science.
Sounds a bit difficult, so yeah, but that sounds interesting. So would you tell me more about your course, or what you teach and what's in the course?
Yeah. Okay, I normally teach in four different areas. The first one is history of science. So a lot of the people who take that class are pre-medical students and mm-hmm. students who are training mm-hmm. to be future STEM teachers. So we actually begin usually about 40,000 BCE, and mm-hmm. we start with the very first evidence of human beings learning something about nature and recording their observations in nature, and we follow that all the way to the present.
Mm-hmm.
So that covers a lot of material.
Yes.
The last time I taught the class, the theme was hidden figures.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of only talking about the most famous people that we all know worldwide who contributed to scientific mm-hmm. knowledge, we, instead of talking about people like Copernicus and Aristotle and Plato and Newton and Einstein mm-hmm. and Darwin, we started to talk about and explore more about all of the women and figures from other races and classes that are mm-hmm. not normally included in that big story of science. So people that we kind of have hidden from history.
Mm-hmm.
The other areas that I teach in, like in arts and humanities, I teach a course in different forms of nature writing. So in that class, we explore poetry about nature, essays about nature, films, and virtually any way that you could explore the natural world, we try to do. So we even look at novels, for instance, or in my case, also Japanese animation.
Mm-hmm.
We even use very famous anime that deal with natural themes.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons I teach that class is to break down the artificial divide that
mm-hmm.
I think there is between the humanities and the sciences.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very artificial divide that we've kind of created in
mm-hmm.
the last 100 years or so. Most of human history, that divide has not been there
mm-hmm.
Because we realize that anybody who has the ability to observe and
mm-hmm.
explore and appreciate something about human nature or the natural world
mm-hmm.
is already doing science. Even if the form that they
mm-hmm.
recorded in might look like poetry or it might look like a graph,
mm-hmm.
it's still science. It's still a way of learning about the natural world. So there's more in common than what most people suspect.
Mm-hmm.
I also teach courses in history of the Great Plains region, which
mm-hmm.
is kind of where we're at in the very southern region down here in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
But that goes all the way up to Canada, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at pioneer literature and Great Plains history and culture, which includes Native American literatures
mm-hmm.
and culture. And then I also teach a course completely devoted to Japanese anime and
mm-hmm.
manga. And the theme most recently for that class has been apocalypse or Brave New World.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the stories that human beings are telling each other right now, I think, are very extreme. It's either the world is going to end or follow me, I have the way to
mm-hmm.
fix the world. And so we're exploring how a lot of stories in other cultures, especially Japanese culture, are not so black and white. They're
mm-hmm.
not so all good, all bad. But instead, almost every kind of negative thing that could happen to humanity
mm-hmm.
also has built into it a potential way out, or a way of resolving or healing. And
mm-hmm.
a lot of American stories don't do that. We either end with a disaster, and maybe
mm-hmm.
one or two people survive,
mm-hmm.
but you don't get to learn what happens to them. Or everything's golden in the end, and everybody lives happily ever after. But most stories in Japanese anime are far more complicated, and I think far more realistic to what
mm-hmm.
most human beings experience in life,
mm-hmm.
is that life will ask an awful lot of us at times, and sometimes it seems like literally the world is ending around
mm-hmm.
us, but then there's always a way within us, if we can find hope and resilience, to rebuild our worlds. And
mm-hmm.
a lot of times that process actually starts in our heads. It's not the world outside mm-hmm. that's really being referred to. It's the fact that we have to think our way out of things and feel our way out of things when it gets hard.
Wow, I think that I should have taken your course. And then listening to your explanation, I think that there is some common theme across all the course. One is science, and another thing is not just the hidden figure, but the hidden culture and hidden way of thinking. Those,
yes,
not just coming up to the surface, but the underneath. There's all. So you are exploring all those possibilities.
Yes. I think one thing my students are probably surprised to find out mm-hmm. is that, or maybe the thing they end up liking the most, no matter what subject matter I'm teaching, is that all of those courses explore what I call the eternal big questions, which mm-hmm. are cosmic questions,
mm-hmm.
like how did we get here? How did the cosmos originate? What does it mean? What am I doing here? What are you doing here? And then how do human beings in general relate to the cosmos around us, both in terms of our region, even our family groups, our cultures, but then also on a more global scale, on being on spaceship Earth, how do we relate to the cosmos mm-hmm. in general? And I think people are surprised to find out that they can take a humanities class and learn about questions about environmental
mm-hmm.
crises, climate chaos, climate change, the Anthropocene in general, like what kind of responsibility are we going to take for how we've transformed the world, and how are we going to engineer, if we can, our way out of it
mm-hmm.
And back into some kind of sustainable, healthy environment. But I think also they're excited because then they realize that there's a lot of power in understanding things
mm-hmm.
through the humanities that apply to a lot of things beyond what we can depend on the sciences to do for us. We need both to work together.
Mm-hmm. So that for the students, this is not something they're familiar with, how to think about it. So they came to the humanity class to take a humanity course,
right.
But they learned a very big science question and
mm-hmm.
the way of exploring the science. Oh, and then they ended up with what? The more complicated solutions or the...
I hope so. I hope one thing they get out of it is realizing that no matter what their own personal strengths are,
mm-hmm.
that they can contribute a new understanding. And if they pool their way of looking at things and perspectives to the way other people in that class do,
mm-hmm.
that they could actually build up to something that could be put into real life practice. I especially see that happening in the nature writing. It's usually ARHM 3342 class because I call it an activist humanities,
mm-hmm.
where we're going to learn about these big natural questions through the humanities, but then we're also going to try to come up with a business plan of
mm-hmm.
some kind of project where you can take your art, your literature, your history, your philosophy, anything that you learn from the humanities, and then apply it to solving a real-world problem. And I've had students come up with really cool projects on ways to reduce light pollution
mm-hmm.
in DFW, ways to create a more sustainable environment here on campus. I've had
mm-hmm.
students come up with really cool ideas for like hydroponic fish ponds that
mm-hmm.
we could put on these roofs that we all have to look out on.
Uh-huh.
I mean, ways to green the space that's above our eye
uh-huh.
level. So they've come up with really amazing things. Also, concepts for starting organic food carts
mm-hmm.
so that each building would have healthy choices and not
mm-hmm.
just vending machine choices.
Uh-huh.
This all came from humanities students
mm-hmm.
who identified a human problem and feel like they can pool their information and learn about the science, feel empowered to do that if they have the right kind of materials.
Mm-hmm. So after taking this course, did the students realize that their potential, that they can think of a lot and explore a lot, and also they have some action plan to do?
Yes, and it's not only just the, you know, the nature writing class that happens, and it also happens in my this class for, it's called Perspectives on Science for the Future STEM Teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have to do some kind of lesson plan at the end. And so for them, this last couple years, I've been having them create actual lessons that they can put into practice during their practice teaching
mm-hmm.
that will incorporate hidden figures in science.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to find somebody that they've never heard about,
mm-hmm.
learn their story, figure out a way to tell their story,
mm-hmm.
and in many cases they'll create, like for instance, a children's book mm-hmm. out of, for whatever grade they may end up mm-hmm. teaching, that will tell the story of that hidden figure. So they actually have a new material that they can actually put forward. The last time I did it, it was perfect timing because that was the time that Margot Lee Shetterly, who's the author of Hidden mm-hmm. Figures, the book,
yeah.
was on campus, and they actually, the core group that got to work on that project actually got to meet her, so they were excited.
Yeah, yeah. That the Hidden Figures, the movies and mm-hmm. the books, yeah, that was great, and that gives me a lot of the thinking, that the how to think and the what to think. So, how many hidden figures are in your courses?
hundreds.
Hundreds.
Yeah, in fact, right behind you is a full-life statue cut out of Benedict Cumberbatch, who right now is wearing a graduation robe that is covered with all the, what I call the hidden stars, the mm-hmm. constellation of hidden figures who are, for instance, in the ancient and medieval world, 99% of medical practitioners were probably women.
Yes.
And people who did not leave behind any written record. So they're not written into the history. We know they existed because mm-hmm. of oral traditions, but they get completely left out. People who did cooking and gardening and mm-hmm. created an herb garden in their kitchens mm-hmm. or outside their kitchen windows, all of those folks count as being yeah. early practitioners. So all of those people we include. Also all the sisters and the wives and the daughters
yes.
of famous figures who were labeled as assistants.
Assistant, yes, like a Caroline Herschel.
Yes, yeah. exactly like Caroline Herschel, but who are also practitioners in their own right. We are mm-hmm. now learning that we can tell their stories that way. It doesn't have to be somebody who was the top 1% of 1% to get mm-hmm. into the story. Most of science is done by the other 99.9.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the stories that we can now start to recover. I also find it's fun to teach about sort of these heroes of science
mm-hmm.
By using fictional characters. Mm-hmm. So even in my anime classes, mm-hmm. we often have an entire semester devoted to heroes of science who
mm-hmm.
also happen to be the main characters in anime.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite one is Nausicaa.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I love that, too.
I
yeah.
know. Who is not, you know, she does not present herself as a scientist per
mm-hmm.
se, although she does show herself as an explorer of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And she has an empathy with nature that she does not impose her will on nature. She doesn't, you know, tear nature down to its smallest parts. Instead, she tries to learn about it in the way it needs to be understood.
Mm-hmm.
And so she keeps nature whole. She doesn't
mm-hmm.
cut it down into particulate matter.
Mm-hmm.
She tries to understand how everything is connected. So she, to me, she's a hero because she, in the way the story unfolds, she's probably only a very young girl, probably
mm-hmm.
14 or 15 years old, but she has a way of seeing that lets her see farther into the future and deeper into the nature of things. And that's her superpower.
Mm-hmm.
What makes her heroic is standing up for and defending that vision of things.
Yeah, that's something that I was curious about, that the characters in the science movies or the animes. So I told you about that. You told me about that, the science heroes or
mm-hmm.
the heroines. In just like Nausicaa, they don't identify themselves as a scientist, but
right.
actually they do science in
mm-hmm.
a great way. So I was curious that how they usually identify themselves, that not scientists, but in something different, and also how the readers or the viewers
mm-hmm.
identify those heroes of science
mm-hmm.
as a hero of science or
right.
someone else,
right.
especially in case of the women character.
True. I think it's complicated,
mm-hmm.
and a couple different thoughts come to mind on that. On the one hand, most of the female characters do not identify themselves as the heroes
mm-hmm.
of their story.
Yes.
They see themselves as playing a small part.
Mm-hmm.
They see themselves as reluctant
mm-hmm.
to put themselves out there or to try their skills because they don't feel prepared.
Mm-hmm.
Usually they are, when you first are introduced to the story, especially the way, for instance, Miyazaki Hayao
mm-hmm.
develops his stories, they would almost seem like they're going to be side characters.
Mm-hmm.
And then they
yeah.
have to literally grow into the part.
Yes,
or
the growing, that's an interesting
mm-hmm.
part, yes.
Yeah, often that's exactly what it is. It's a growing up story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's they come into their strengths and they then realize that they are doing some good for their people. Almost always it's for something larger than themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that aspect. And then the other part of it is that there's the things that they do well, the things that end up being their their true weapons,
mm-hmm.
you know, the things that are effective, aren't weapons at all.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's kind of like a story out of The Art of War, I think, in that the true strength is learning how not to ever go to battle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you are good enough at using empathy
yeah.
and compassion actively, you never have to hurt anyone. And that can be the greatest way to win is by
mm-hmm.
never fighting the war
mm-hmm.
to begin with. Both sides win then. And so I think in a lot of cases, it's not so much engagement of an agony or a struggle or a battle, but instead it will be, you'll see these main characters trying to find a deeper well of hope, a deeper way to bounce back from adversity, a deeper way of working together. So their superpowers end up being things like hope and resilience and
mm-hmm.
creativity and agile minds,
mm-hmm.
people who can learn from each other across cultures, across generations.
Mm-hmm.
And even in case of Nausicaa, if you look ever read the manga version, which is much, much longer, more complicated story, she even has to learn across dimensions into
mm-hmm.
the spiritual world
mm-hmm.
and bring what she learns back from that.
Mm. So I think that could happen to the reader's mind too. So do you think that it happened in the real world? So the learning from the manga or the learning from the anime?
I absolutely believe that happens. I think one of the most interesting things about having the great opportunity to teach anime and manga has been what I've learned about how visual storytelling
mm-hmm.
So deeply affects readers' identification with the characters. That a lot of our students are quite engaged in anime.
Mm-hmm.
They are quite engaged in manga characters. They almost think of them as their friends.
Mm-hmm.
It's partly a fandom kind of issue, but also I think it's because it's such an effective medium of storytelling that people, partly because these stories start off often not with somebody who's already very good at what
mm-hmm.
they do, which can often be hard to identify
mm-hmm.
with, but as somebody who feels small and inadequate.
I think that that's a very good point for the science education, because when I teach science to the students, one thing I always face is the image of the mad scientist. Yeah?
Right.
And then also another thing, the scientist, the only scientist, the Einstein.
Uh-huh.
always the very famous figure, and the
this
scientist must do those things. And so they don't recognize there are just ordinary, everyday worker science
mm-hmm.
around us.
Mm-hmm.
But these types of the stories, and then also the visual images, and
mm-hmm.
I think that will give the students and the people, and especially the children,
mm-hmm.
that science is actually around us, and we can do it,
right.
those things.
Right, absolutely. And I think, too, very subtly, a lot of the anime storytelling of the kinds of that I include in my classes include a vision of nature,
mm-hmm.
where nature is not separate from humans, but one that humans need to get closer to and understand more deeply, so that there's that curiosity that's inspired, is that why not go out and look for yourself? Why
mm-hmm.
don't you remember how it used to be when you were small and you thought even a blade of grass was amazing?
Mm-hmm.
Can you get back to being that childlike wonder that you had before, and can you make that alive in yourself no matter how old you are? So I always think about that with a character like Sophie in Howl's Moving Castle, where
mm-hmm.
she prematurely grows old, but she also realizes she still has an inner child.
Yeah.
So that part is part of the spark of science learning, too, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I learned a lot today also. So the word that pops in my mind is that in your course, one thing is the discovery. We discovered, yeah,
right.
something we didn't know there.
And
another thing is, of course, exploration. Yes,
yes.
Exploration. And, well, final thing is that we all learn that we are very step closer to the science around us. I think that, yeah, that's
yes.
what we could have in from your course. Yes,
yeah.
That's very nice and interesting also.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I'd like to talk more about that, but
mm-hmm.
we have to have a wrap of time. So,
got
yeah.
you.
So, thank you, Fan, for talking with us today and to learn more about Dr. Pamela Gusin and her wonderful story and courses. And please visit the Creative Disturbance site at creativedisturbance.org. Thank you.